Blog Talk Radio.
Oh, that's great. That sounds terrific. Thank you.
With the possibility of parole, which without a pardon means, in essence, that he would have to serve 38 years before he would be even eligible for parole, despite the pleas from Ursuline's attorney, Irvin Box, and 30,000 signed petitions asking that Ursuline be set free. Tonight we want to hear from you, reactions from the Oklahoma City community on what do you think about the Jerome Ursuline sentence. Was it fair? Do you feel that it was too harsh? Did the jury get it wrong? A lot of people said in the Casey Anthony trial that the jury got it wrong. Do you think that they got it wrong with Jerome Ursuline? Or was justice served? I've seen some of the Facebook comments this week, and they are harsh. Both sides seem to be going at each other because despite all of the information that's been put out there, the interrogation videos, the 911 calls, the footage from the shooting that day, the actual footage from the store or the pharmacy, it still seems to be where everybody's looking at the same information, but everybody's looking at it a little different, or there's two sides, I guess I should say, to this debate. And some are diehard Ursuline supporters. They feel that he absolutely did what he had to do to defend the pharmacy that day and the two workers that were in there, despite others feeling that it was absolute cold-blooded murder. Some feel that Ursuline had a clean shot on the first shot, but absolutely it was overkill on the second, the third, the fourth, and the fifth shot after that. And so, or the sixth shot, as well. And so, what do you think tonight? I've thought about it long and hard over these last couple of weeks because we covered the topic, Jerome Ursuline, guilty or innocent of murder, part one and two. And I listened to both sides, and it is really one very heated debate in Oklahoma City. And so I want to hear from you tonight. What do you think as far as you know, if you're a member of the Oklahoma City community, what are the feelings down there this evening? I think the verdict came down about 10 o'clock today, and it was online immediately, and I think the battle began there. So I really want to hear from you. I'm waiting for some of my guests to call in tonight. Attorney Anthony McKesson, an Oklahoma City criminal attorney, is supposed to be with us tonight. Disc jockey Carl King. He's with an Oklahoma City radio network down there. And we're also waiting on Reverend J.A. Reed to call in tonight. He's a pastor with the Fairview Baptist Church in Oklahoma City. And they're right there on the ground in Oklahoma City. So I really wanted to hear their reactions first before we went to the phone lines to hear from you. I think one of my guests is with me. I'm going to check, and then we're going to see if we can find out where the location of the other two are. Good evening. Welcome to Center Stage. Good evening.
Hello.
Hi, how are you? Hello? Hello?
Wait, hello?
Hello? Is this Mr. McKesson?
This is Anthony McKesson.
Hi, McKesson. How are you?
I'm doing well. And yourself?
I'm good. Thank you for joining us early. We're still waiting on Carl King and Reverend J.L. Reed to join us. Mr. McKesson, you're an Oklahoma City criminal attorney. What is the feeling down there? You work around the courthouse. What is the feeling today after the verdict came in or the sentencing came in?
Well, I can't speak to how it was today because quite frankly, I did not have any court business, so I didn't have any desire to be down at the courthouse. What I can say leading up to it is that, you know, attorneys, you know, and I think attorneys, we view things differently than many in the public in that, you know, we certainly understand, you know, kind of the likelihood of what the judge's sentencing was going to be today. And so there was more kind of discussions about tactical approaches as far as how the case maybe could have been argued differently and how it could be argued in the future. But as far as generally what I hear in the community, just in walking around and just in my own church, you know, I would say that there's a lot of people who view themselves as conservatives who disagree with the verdict, and certainly I'm sure would disagree with the formal sentencing, and who feel that Mr. Ursulin is a hero and should not have been charged, much less convicted.
Wow. Let's see if one of our other guests have arrived. Good evening. You're on center stage. Good evening.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
Yes. Who am I speaking with?
Mr. Dixon.
This is who?
Mr. Dixon.
Oh, hey, Pastor Dixon. I thought you were one of our guests. I'm going to put you back on hold for a second.
Okay.
And so, Mr. McKesson, I think the vibe I saw online, and I'm sure you saw some of that on Facebook, was kind of heated. Both sides seem
very,
to be
very heated. Very
heated.
Heated.
Both sides seem to be very set in their beliefs about what they feel happened, and they're not giving one inch. And so it's a lot of name calling. And I don't know. I think we talked before about the Make My Day law, and a lot of people felt that this was justified under the Make My Day law. Obviously, it was not.
Well, in my opinion, that no, the Make My Day law was not applicable, that he exceeded that, and apparently the jury came to that same conclusion.
Can you kind of briefly tell us what the Make My Day law says?
Basically, and I'm going to paraphrase the Oklahoma Make My Day law, but basically the Make My Day law says that a homeowner or a individual in a business that they are allowed to protect themselves from physical harm by the use of reasonable force when the threat of harm is imminent and dangerous, and that it goes for the protection of person but does not go against the protection of property. In other words, you're not allowed lawfully to use deadly force to protect property such as money or prescription narcotics.
Okay. So we had State Senator Shorty on another show that you were on, and State Senator Shorty said that he was trying to get then passed, and I believe he's still working on it, the Jerome Ursulin Act, which would be somewhat of an extension to the Make My Day law, which would allow a owner of a store or someone in Jerome Ursulin's situation to shoot like Jerome Ursulin did, and it would be justified. But currently that is not the case under the Oklahoma law, the Oklahoma Make My Day law right now, correct?
Right, and State Senator Shorty, you know, based on what he himself said, he said that the legislation that he's proposing would say that as long as the shooter, the person such as Mr. Ursulin, felt that their actions was reasonable, then there would be no other questions asked. So it leaves it to the individual in question to either say, you know, I was operating under fear and law enforcement is supposed to just accept that, or the shooter would say, you know, oh, I was acting improperly, which we know no sane person is ever going to say that. So,
but it seems like to me, don't you think there needs to be a revision one way or another on the Make My Day law? Because currently, as it stands, even in some states it's known as the Castle Doctrine, it seems like to me all you have to do is say the right words, and therefore most law enforcement consider it justified. And I think that's the case. I got an email after we did the second show on Jerome Ursulin, and basically what the person said to me was pretty shocking. Basically what he said in so many words was that in Oklahoma, a criminal, whatever happens to him, he deserves. So if Antoine Speedy Parker went into the pharmacy that day with the intent to rob the pharmacy, and he said could possibly, you know, even have killed someone that day, that whatever happened to him, he absolutely brought on himself. And he said that is just the general feeling in Oklahoma, a city, that if a criminal is found to be a criminal, whatever you know, happens to him, it just happens. And that's just how they feel down there. So that's why he was explaining to me in the email, that's why people in Oklahoma were feeling so strongly about the way that they felt that, that Ursulyn should be found not guilty, was because they absolutely felt like Antoine Speedy Parker was the one that was wrong. So therefore, everything Ursulyn did had to be considered right. And how do you respond to that?
Well, my response is that if we're going to talk about a mob mentality, then that assessment is correct. You know, I myself, you know, the very first time that we talked about the Oklahoma mindset, you know, I myself have said that we have kind of an old west throwback mentality of that people take care of themselves, and when someone is wronged, we shoot first and generally never ask any questions later. But if we are supposed to be a society in which we're governed by rules and laws, the law has always been that you can't just simply shoot just because you think that the person had it coming, that there are certain limitations to the use of deadly force and the potential of taking human life. And so, you know, it just seems to me that we have people who are complaining about a system that they didn't complain about for hundreds of years, and Mr. Ursulyn has been judged under a system that has the same flaws and the same perks that other people have had. And I, for one, say that if we're going to change the system, don't change it for Mr. Ursulyn, you change it for everyone. And Ursulyn supporters, I've never heard one of them say that the system needs to be changed for everyone. They want to carve an exception out for one individual who, in their mind, didn't deserve it. But then the penitentiaries are filled with people who have family members and loved ones who feel that those people don't deserve to be locked up, and no one is crying for their freedoms, or no one is saying that they were unjustly incarcerated.
You know, one thing I noticed that I'd never seen in a case before is prior to this man even being sentenced, they went and collected 30,000 signatures. Do you feel that it would be fair for 30,000 signatures to override what 12 jurors came to the conclusion after having seen all the evidence and been presented with the case the way that they had been in a court of law, that the 30,000 signatures should override that?
Well, I believe that based upon the way that the pardon and parole board system is set up, that there is always a need for a potential safeguard. But the safeguard should be based upon that we give people new trials or we throw out verdicts if we believe that the legal system did not work the way it's supposed to, not because we didn't like the outcome. And what I've heard from the Ursulyn supporters is they just simply don't like the outcome. They've, you know, they said it was unfair about the way that the police investigated. Well, his case was investigated really no differently than anyone else's. They've complained about, you know, the judge's rulings on certain motions that excluded certain information. Well, that same judge and other judges, you know, make those same rulings on other individuals. And so, and also our Court of Criminal Appeals has routinely for decades has said that the very thing that the Ursulyn supporters have complained about have been justified and have been consistent with the Oklahoma and the United States Constitution.
I agree. So, you know, and they're complaining about what Judge Ray Elliott did, but wasn't there another judge on the case before this one?
Well, there was a Judge Terry Bass LeSure, which kind of ironically, some people have said that this is a racially motivated argument. Well, Judge Elliott is white, and Judge Tammy Bass LeSure is African-American, and the Ursulyn supporters were all in favor of Judge Bass LeSure because my understanding is that she initially had allowed virtually all the defense motions, and there would have been far more evidence introduced. But then when the case got transferred to Judge Elliott, that he reversed the previous judge's decision and excluded a lot of evidence.
Wow. Is that normal?
Well, it is certainly within each trial judge's discretion, and kind of knowing each judge and kind of their philosophical views or approaches, what Judge Bachelet sure did is fairly consistent with you know, just about any defendant that comes in, and that she believes in letting a lot of information in and educating the jury, whereas Judge Elliott takes a more conservative approach.
Someone said that in the Casey Anthony case, they never saw the jurors taking any notes. How important is it that the jury takes notes during the trial so that they can keep up with all the information that is, you know, being presented in front of them?
Well, that is something that has been I've been practicing law for 22 years, and I'm sure this debate's been going on longer than that, but even in law school, there was always that debate of should jurors be allowed to take notes, and what I can tell you is that those who are in favor of note-taking says that, you know, certainly we as attorneys and the judges, we take notes during the trials to help us recall information and help us focus on points, and that, you know, one argument is that a jury should be able to do the same thing, but there's also the argument that you should not let a jury take notes because people take notes at different degrees of depth and quality, and if you get someone who is a very detailed note taker, some feel that person will have an unfair advantage of persuading the jury because other jurors may think, well, if their notes are more detailed, their notes may be accurate. And, you know, one of the things with also with notes is that sometimes when people take notes, they don't look at the witnesses, so they don't have the advantage of watching facial expressions and gestures and listening to the influx of people's voices. So that's one of those that it just depends on the judge whether or not they let the jurors take notes or not.
Now, in the Casey Anthony trial, the jury was sequestered for 44 days, I believe. In this particular trial, was that the case?
I do not believe that they were sequestered.
Wow. So that means that they were privy to all of this stuff. I'm sure under instructions they were not supposed to, but let's just say maybe some of them got, you know, wind of some of these things that were going on the Internet or on television. So they had the capability of being swayed by some of the outside influences.
Well, there's always that possibility that, you know, jurors might have disobeyed the court order and might have let people talk to them about what they saw on TV, and also potential jurors could have disobeyed the order and watched news coverage. So, so again, Mr. Ursuline is no different in that I would say probably 98% of trials in Oklahoma County, the jurors get to go home, and we as attorneys are told that we need to rely on people's honesty as to whether or not they're following the court order or not. And unless you have pretty strong evidence to the contrary, the court presumes that people follow those instructions, even though they could be, you know, disregarding it the very second they, you know, they walk in their doors.
How many days was this trial?
A little less than 2 weeks. It might have been around 10 days.
Wow, that's a long time not to hear anything about this case when it's all over the place, I'm sure, in Oklahoma City.
Well, and also on top of that, you have to keep in mind that for almost 2 years, this case has been a very high-profile case in Oklahoma City. So even if you had jurors who, during the trial, never watched anything else about the coverage during the trial, they had the pretrial publicity, which you know, may or may not have formed their opinions ahead of time.
Wow. Okay, Mr. Dixon, I'm sorry. Now we're going to come to you. I just wanted to get a couple of things straight. How are you doing this evening?
I'm doing fine.
What do you think of the case so far? Or it's over now, but what do you think of the Jerome Ursuline sentencing? Do you think it was fair?
Yes, I think it was fair.
And why do you think that is?
Well, based upon the video that I saw, the second thing that he did as a reference to coming back in, which showed no sign of anybody moving or anything of that nature, and when he went and got the gun a second time and came back and shot more and more, which basically to me somewhat would have been classified as an overkill.
But he said, and Mr. McKesson can correct me if I'm mistaken, I think Ursuline said that the boy was getting up, even though he'd been shot in the head, that he was getting up and he had a gun. Was that not correct, Mr. McKesson?
Well, yeah, that Antoine Parker was making some type of movement and Mr. Ursuline was fearful that he was reaching for some type of weapon.
Yeah, but normally after somebody's been shot in the head like that, 90% of the time he's not going to get up and do no shooting.
You know what was odd about the last time we did the second part of this show, or the second part of the Jerome Ursuline guilty or innocent of murder? Someone called in, and I don't know if they were in the medical profession or not, but they made the comment that because he was shot in the head, he was probably dead anyway. You remember that comment somebody made, Mr. McKesson? And they said
I remember that.
Yeah, they said he was probably dead anyway. And someone brought to my recollection after that show, they said the congresswoman, Gifford, is still alive today, and she was shot in the head at point-blank range. So to just assume someone was going to die just because they'd been shot in the head, I don't know. But someone said that he was probably going to die anyway, or he was probably dead. But if he was probably dead, he couldn't have been getting up.
Right, but they also went so far as to say that they believed that the medical examiner's office was incompetent and botched the examination.
Yes.
And that the examiner didn't know, did not know competently that Mr. Parker was in fact dead, under their beliefs.
Mm-hmm. And I'm not taking sides tonight, y'all, but you know what? One thing I really do want to do is talk about all the facts, because I think if you're going to figure out how this case got to where it ended, then you have to understand how the role that it took. And I think from day one, I think the police department is pretty much saying that there was contradictions in Mr. Ursuline's story, and I think that's probably where this started to unravel, in my opinion, for Ursuline, was that the statements that he made to police the day that he was interrogated without an attorney. And I'm not sure, Mr. McKesson, why did he choose to go and talk to the police without an attorney?
Well, I can only speculate, but my speculation is I think that he thought that no one would really question his story, that they would just take it at face value and pat him on the back and send him on his way.
Okay. Well, he went in and he was interrogated for quite a while, and he made some statements, during that time that police obviously went back through with the fine-tooth comb and found inconsistencies in things like, he said that he had, gotten a back injury during the Iraq Gulf War, I believe, and that he was had killed many people. When they found out that he was just a chief pharmacist in some part of Oklahoma during that part of the war. Is that not right, Mr. McKesson? Am I getting this right?
No, you're getting that correct.
And so that was one inconsistency that was major, I believe, in that, because first of all, you tell the police, I've killed a whole bunch of people. That raises a big flag. And then, for them to find out, well, that's not true, and then they find out that you never was in combat, that you actually were just a chief pharmacist, that's a big flag. And then, there's been things like they're saying he doesn't have a broken back, he just had, I think, osteoarthritis, you know, and this man was on some pretty strong medication, from what I understand, the opiate. That's like, I'm assuming, in the family of opium, which I think the jail does not even give to him or administer to him because they don't give that to inmates. And so I think that's another inconsistency that has been found out, you know, during this that has hurt Ursuline. And so I think whenever they start finding inconsistencies in your story, that speaks to your credibility. And so, you know, I think he said that when the would-be robbers came in the store, they came in shooting. When I think the police said they never found any bullet casings, you know, from the would-be robbers' guns. You know, so I think all of those things played a big role in what happened with the way this turned out for Ursuline in terms of why he was given the sentence that he was given. I don't know if I think he got the right sentence, but I think to be found guilty, you know, maybe – this is why he was found guilty, was because of all the inconsistencies which spoke to his credibility. Because, you know, they said Antoine Speedy Parker never had a gun, but Ursuline said that he did. There was some other things that, you know, he basically told them that he had been injured in combat and he hadn't. And he told the Oklahomian that he had a broken, inoperable T5 back, but come to find out, it's just osteoarthritis. And so I think all the inconsistencies, I think if you're a juror and you're sitting in the jury box and you're listening to all of this and someone's saying, you know, here's the video that shows that this man shot, you know, a kid that was already down, you know, it says something's wrong. It, you know, and I don't know if I want to believe that the drugs that he was on had something to do with it. I mean, do you all think if you're on very heavy medication and you got two guns in the building and you're confronted with a robbery, that maybe that could be just the wrong ingredients for disaster? I mean, the right ingredients for disaster?
Well,
Mr. Dixon or Attorney McKesson?
Well, I certainly believe that certainly anytime anyone is using you know, powerful medications or alcohol, anything that that can kind of influence our thoughts is certainly not a good combination for anyone that is potentially going to be using deadly force.
Mm-hmm.
So it's certainly not a good idea.
And I don't know why, and I'm sure he probably had the two guns strategically placed in the pharmacy, you know, depending upon what angle someone possibly could rob him, that he would have the ability to easily get, you know, the guns. But at the same time, again, to have be on those type of drugs and then to have guns accessible, you know, when I listened to him on the interrogation tape, it almost as though it seemed to me like he was describing something like an out-of-body experience. It didn't even seem like he was talking about something that seemed logical, because the way he described it himself seemed like it was unreal to him. Like he wasn't in the moment, you know, when it was occurring. That's what I tended to hear. But I don't know. Let's go back to the phone lines. I don't want to say too much about what I think. Y'all tell me what you think tonight. Area code 931, good evening. You're on center stage.
Hey, how you doing? My name is Chris, and I'm down here in Tennessee.
Yes, sir.
I saw your ad on Facebook, so I jumped in here to see what it was about.
Are you familiar with the Jerome Ursuline shooting down in Oklahoma City?
I heard something about it, but I'm not that familiar with it. But what I heard y'all say is this guy was on medication.
Yes.
Now, is this the pharmacist that was on medication?
Yes, the pharmacist that did the shooting was on heavy medication. Oh, I think it's
okay.
Opiate, which I'm assuming is in the opium family.
Well, I'm going to say anything with a bum is either Valium, opium, or something like that. Well, my question is, the heck with him shooting the guy, why was he prescribing being able to fill medication if he's on heavy narcotic medication?
Mr. McKesson, that may be a question for you.
Well, I don't know the answer to that. My understanding is that in order to get a license for a gun, they look at things like that. And also, I'm presuming that that pharmacists have to be members of a board, kind of like lawyers have to be a member of a board. And I can only presume that that somebody had been informed of the medications he was taking and was confident that, you know, that he was clear thinking. But I don't have a direct answer if he's on that
medication. Now, if I take Demerol, Paraphonte Fortis, GABA, I can't pronounce the word, it's gabapentin or something like that. It's for nerves, but it's for about 20 other things. Well, that disqualifies me from driving a truck.
Wow.
And, I mean, they're not narcotics. They're just nerve blockers.
Wow. You know, I found it like, you know, I don't know what that must have been like, but I can imagine if you're on some really strong medication and you're overly medicated and possibly even addicted to it, because, you know, they say he does not have a broken back as the medication was prescribed for it. Now, who wrote the prescription is the best question to ask, but...
Uh-huh.
So you wonder, you know, if it was like all of this was just like going on like in slow motion. You know how sometimes you have those out-of-body experiences and it doesn't seem real to you? I'm just wondering if that was the case that day, that when it all happened, it was just the right situation at the wrong time. It just happened. And
well, it's kind of like when you're in a wreck. You know, that goes in slow motion for some strange reason.
Right.
And, you know, I've been robbed. And, I mean, you know, you could tell when somebody was going to rob you. You got that feeling.
Wow.
But, you know, you just can't pull your gun and shoot. Because I wanted to do that myself. Because when somebody come around from behind the building, and normally you're supposed to come to the front of the building, you know what I'm saying? They got their hands in their coats like that. And the guy robbed, but I didn't shoot him. And he didn't shoot me, thank God. But if I'd have pulled my gun out and shot him, then maybe the guy was just scratching his belly, you know?
Wow.
You can't shoot somebody until you actually see the gun. But if he's on medication, then, you know, the guy might could have actually thought he was on the medication. But then, but down here, we've heard a lot of people griping about the girl down in Florida who got off. Well, I think the jury, you know, did their job. If there wasn't enough evidence within a reasonable doubt, you know, they should set her free. And there wasn't. And I think a lot of these people could be getting off because of all this TV publicity, thanks to the little blonde-headed bimbo. I won't mention her name, but everybody knows who she is at Six Feet Under. She gets on TV, and I mean, she won't be convicted from day one.
Well, you know what? Is there something wrong with our jury system, though? I mean, the way that it's designed, because, you know, from state to state, this thing could have gone either way. You know, and so you wonder if maybe we need an overhaul of the way we're doing this thing because, you know, it is clear to me, and I can think of several states, possibly the one I live in, that this would have went totally a different direction. Or in South Carolina, this would have probably went.
If he was in Alabama, he would have walked.
See, that's what I mean. And so
why would he walk if he was in Alabama?
Because he's a white boy and shot a black guy, brother.
The thing about it is, and I really appreciate the caller's comment because one thing that we've all done is tiptoed around that issue, and there have been different times that we've had different points where we've said that we believe that if Ursuline had been black and Antoine Parker had been white, that the outcomes also would have been different. That race has a factor, and I think unfortunately that's true.
And all over the internet, everybody kept saying,
I call a nation a spade, brother. I mean, and that's the truth. I mean, I have seen lower income white and blacks who live in the projects, and you know what I'm talking about, the cop or po-po, whatever anybody wants to nickname them, come in there, I bust these kids for drugs instead of going right across the mountain over to Mountain Brook or to Nashville, popping the white son of a gun lawyers who is helping bringing it in.
You're right.
Oh, we spent $50,000 on this. Well, they could have spent the $25,000 and went after the main man.
That's very
right. But they use it on statistics to fluff their arrest records to get more government grants.
You know, nobody wants to call it the race card, but you know, it's really the truth. I mean, really. I mean, a lot of people, you know, all over the internet kept saying everybody's playing the race card, but in a lot of situations, I don't think people realize that that's just what it was. I mean, well, let me stop. Okay, thank you, caller.
All right.
Thank you. Okay, we're going to go to the next call. Area code 405-234. Good evening. You're on center stage.
Good evening.
Good evening.
I live in Oklahoma City, and I believe the jury did the job, and he got what he deserved. I mean, in the end, he snapped. That's all there is to it, whether he was drugged out or not. He snapped, and he executed the kid, and he deserves to be punished for it. It's no different than any other time someone snaps.
So did his attorney not enter the right plea for him? Should he have pleaded insanity as opposed to not guilty?
Oh, it's possibly temporary insanity, but, at the same time, he understood the difference between right and wrong.
So Colin, do you feel like the first shot was a clean shot and the other five were not?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, if it stopped after the first shot, I think he did nothing wrong. It's the continual shots. I mean, the fact that he lied about when the five shots happened, to me, shows he knew he did wrong.
Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, when he said he ran by as he was running out the door to chase the other guy, that's when he took the additional shots. But we know that not to be true. So he showed he knew he had done wrong during the police interview, or he wouldn't have lied about when the other shots happened.
But could he have been confused about the facts?
How can you be confused about that whenever he can remember that the getaway car was missing a hubcap? I mean, how do you get that confused?
Very true.
Then right after that, he calls the 911. It was right after he took them shots. He called 911. It was the last seconds of his actions.
You know what I found ironic is when he came back in the pharmacy after he pursued the second suspect, he never even went to check on the ladies. Or maybe he just didn't hear it. But he never did seem to go where they were to check and see if they were okay.
He never took a defensive posture through the whole thing. His whole deal was offense, offense, offense. I mean, personally, I think he pre-programmed himself. That's what he was going to do. If someone come in there to rob the place, he was going to teach them a lesson, and he did it.
Yep.
Wow.
That's true.
Wow.
And the fact is, you look into Mr. Ursuline a little more, his divorce in Norman, he was on continued supervised probation or supervised visitation with his children. The older son is not his only children. He has other children, and he's on continued supervised visitation with his children. I mean, the only way you get that is through drug abuse or abuse, physical abuse.
Did that come out during the trial?
I don't think it's ever come out, because you go to OSCN.net, pull up Cleveland County, and go to Jerome Ursuline, and it's there. It's all there in black and white on the minutes of the courts. He's continually on supervised visitation with his children. Jeff Ursuline is his only child.
I mean, he's like 59. Does he have, like, young kids or something?
Well, obviously, otherwise it couldn't be supervised visitation.
I just, for some reason, assume he would have been past, you know, having children. But really, I just question one thing that I saw that was a little odd. Then we're going to move on to the other caller. Was the blue car, in your opinion, involved in this robbery? The blue car that was parked directly in front of the pharmacy. Is that the one?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know on that. I mean, I don't think they've ever even addressed what the blue car was doing or anything. I haven't ever heard anything about the blue car.
Did anybody besides me think that the blue car seemed out of place? And if I saw people running out of pharmacies, you know, with guns and shooting, I would have been, like, frantic. Those guys seemed like they weren't that nervous to me. I don't know.
I don't know how I would react either. But, I mean, he was definitely doing something in the trunk of his car.
But whatever he was doing in the trunk of the car, it had to be connected. Because in my opinion, God forgive me, if I'm wrong, I'm so sorry. But it just seemed like to me, if I saw people running out of I see two boys go in, and I see one boy run out, and somebody run out with a gun behind them and shoots, I would have been like, what the heck's going on? And they did not seem fazed at all by what had happened. And I just found that...
Well, we don't know for sure who the getaway car was. I can't tell by the video if that's the actual other two guys.
That's what I questioned. Was that the other two guys in that car?
That's what I don't know. That's why. Now, per Jerome Ursuline, the car was sitting around the other side of the deal, the other side of the pharmacy. When he came around there, that's when he saw the getaway car. But that very well could have been a lie, too. Nothing he says has been proven to be true. So there's no way of knowing, and I don't know that it was ever addressed. I mean, Mr. Ursuline wants his voice heard, but Mr. Ursuline doesn't want to speak in court. He wants to call our local news station saying he's being neglected or this or that. But in the end, he had opportunities. He could have testified at the hearing. He could have testified today. He could have said something today in his defense. He said nothing. He wants to sit there and be silent. Well, take your lumps. Go to prison.
Wow. That's true. Thank you so much.
But the other thing I want to address, too, is, you know, the proof's in the pudding, too, is the supporter, the lady going out and getting all the signatures, has also been convicted of having possession of methamphetamines, possession of marijuana, and drug charges.
Karen Monahan, I did read that, and Karen was on this show. Karen was on the first show. She did not tell me she knew Ursuline as well as she did, but Karen was on the first show, and I was surprised when I read some of the things that I did. You're exactly right. I think she had been convicted of a felony because her and a boyfriend, some kind of white police, I don't know, went to their home for some reason. I'm not sure if I remember what the reason was.
I don't know the conditions under why they went to her home, but she got found in possession of methamphetamine, possession of marijuana, drugs, and both professed.
Yeah, in 2006 it was marijuana, methamphetamine, guns, digital scale, a bulletproof vest, cash, and her boyfriend was in the home. I think she said she didn't have anything to do with it, but she still pleaded guilty because she said she'd run out of money to fight the case. Thank you for bringing that to our attention. Thank you so much, caller. Yeah.
No problem.
Okay, we're going to go to what appears to be a number. We lost them. It was a 111 number. I'm sorry, caller. I was not able to get to you in time. Karen Monahan was the one who collected the 30,000 signatures, just like the caller just said. And she collected 30,000 signatures, and then she takes the petitions, the signature, the signed petitions, I guess is what I'm trying to say, to the governor's office, and immediately after that she's investigated. And she's investigated, and I don't know if I feel that was right. I'll be honest with you. Karen boycotted my show on the second show, and I'm not happy about that, but I'm going to give her a break. I really think they did her wrong. I think just because she brought the petitions was not fair for them to investigate her past, but they did do that. We're going to go to area code 111111 again. Good evening. You're on center stage.
Good evening.
Hi.
Hi, Carrie. Hi, Mr. McKesson. This is Kiki.
Hey.
Hey, how you doing?
Hi. I'm just calling in. I actually was calling in because the previous caller that mentioned the research that he did on OSCN when he looked up the divorce proceedings and the records from Mr. Ursuline's divorce proceedings showed that Mr. Ursuline had to have supervised visits with his child that was, the minor child involved in the divorce proceedings at that time. I believe that was his first or second wife. I think it might have been his second wife. But just I just wanted to call in and segue on the OSCN thing, and because it is a matter of public record, and just kind of touch on the Karen Monahan issue. But he beat me to it, so I was just calling in after the fact. But I just find it interesting that it seems that all the way around this case with Ursuline and some of his most vocal supporters, credibility seems to be consistent across the board. And I just find it interesting that Karen, particularly being one of the most vocal of Ursuline's supporters, taking advantage of the media, to shed some spotlight on her cause, has the kind of background and record that she does.
Mm.
I just think that it is a conflict of interest for someone, when you look up OSCN, and you look at the convictions. Now, this isn't a matter of not guilty. This isn't a matter of something being dismissed. These are the disposition of her charges are convictions. and she entered a guilty plea. So I'm trying to understand how she can come after the fact and say that she didn't have the money to fight the case, but her plea was guilty.
And you know what?
You
know? And Kiki, you know I'm not happy with Karen boycotting my show on the second show about Ursula. But
you know,
I was going to
touch on that, Carrie. I was going to touch on that, but I'm glad you brought that up. Go ahead.
Okay, knock yourself out. I mean, really, but I don't know that they did her fair on this. I mean, really, and Karen, you know I ain't happy with you, but I don't feel like it was fair just because she collected 30,000 signatures, signed petitions. Why would they investigate her, though, just because she turned
well,
in
a Carrie, that's the society that we live in.
Yeah.
That's the society that we live in. Anytime you place yourself out there like that and you become an advocate for a cause, then you place yourself in a position to have your background checked into. The President of the United States has to go through it, so why wouldn't Joe Blow or Joe Plummer over here, as they say, be, you know, someone that's not held accountable to that same standard? You know,
but she was just turning in the signatures, though. I mean, I was thinking, I didn't think you had to have a background check to turn in 30,000 signed petitions.
But no, ma'am.
So
it's not about the signatures. It's not about the signatures. You know, the signatures, that's one issue. And, hey, you got to give her props for that because she was very diligent and she's very devoted to her cause and her belief that Mr. Ursuline is not guilty and that he should be released. I applaud her for that. Anytime somebody stands up for something that they believe in and they fight, you know, you've got to give them credit for that. But at the same time, when you stand up and you fight and you lend your name to that cause, you are also opening yourself up to be looked into and to have your background checked into. And to me, I just believe, and this is just my opinion, but when you lend your name to something, if you are not open and prepared to have your background ripped apart, and people to dig up information on you, then you should not lend your name to that cause. And specifically, you should not seek out the media outlets to you know, gain the spotlight and have the media to help your cause, as particularly if you have the kind of background that you have. This is someone who is seeking out members of Oklahoma politicians, okay, to rally behind her cause and to support her position on the issue, yet she has been not only entered a guilty plea, but has been convicted of possession of a controlled dangerous substance, including methamphetamine.
But this is where I had a problem with.
That still should have anything as a reference to her collecting signatures based upon what she did in the past. Because I don't think there's anybody that's living on this earth that hadn't done something in the past that possibly could come up. It's still a new person.
And I agree.
I totally agree.
Also, Carrie, what I wanted to say was, I think one of the things that they need to look at and learn from this is that pharmacists should also be drug tested many times here because of the fact that they do have access to drugs, and we don't know as a reference to whether or not they're drug addicts themselves.
Correct.
And you know what?
I completely agree with that.
I think the connection between her having a previous, you know, drug history or a criminal history with drugs and Ursuline being a pharmacist, I think that just didn't go over well. Maybe if she had been with something else, you know, been charged with something else, maybe it wouldn't have even been an issue. Maybe they wouldn't have even brought it up. But maybe they brought it up just to show the connection.
Possibly. I mean, and you know, the media is always guilty of sensationalizing things and trying to connect the dots on issues that really, in reality, aren't really connected because, you know, it's a ratings fight. It's a fight for the highest ratings and the most readers and the most hits on their web pages also. So, you know, you have to keep those things in perspective when you're reading this stuff. But, you know, the gentleman that mentioned something about the pharmacist having to be tested for drugs, you know, there's a flip side to this because one of the things that the supporters have been vocal about is that, you know, the prescription drugs and people are, you know, across the nation, it's been, you know, broadcast on the news outlets that pharmacies and pharmacists, drugstores are becoming targets because the drug of choice nowadays appears to be the prescription pain medications.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but the flip side of that is that oftentimes the people who legally have a right to dispense these medications are actually taking advantage of their positions, and they're, in a sense, becoming legal drug pushers to these people that are addicted to these drugs. And it's, you know, a possibility that they not only are addicted themselves, but they're facilitating, you know, dispensing of the prescription drugs also, you know. And I just found it really interesting in what I read today that Mr. Ursuline's x-rays that were taken at the jail did not reveal any fractures whatsoever.
You know, Kiki, on the first show, Kiki was on the first show that was titled Jerome Ursuline Guilty or Innocent of Murder, and I brought up the back brace, and I think you interrupted me and said, oh, but Carrie, I don't think that has anything to do with, in all due respect, you were taking up for him, remember? About the back brace. And so
when I saw that today, I thought the same thing,
wow. You know, I brought that up just to tell the people that the picture that they were seeing of him with the back brace on was because he said he had a back injury. And come to find out, the jailhouse medical staff says he has no back injury.
I believe that he said he had a T5 fracture. And what we were talking about on the first show is how is it possible that he had so much agility and ability to move around in the manner in which he did, considering he had a pre-existing back injury and was wearing a brace. And I defended him in saying that, you know, the fight or flight thing maybe came into play at that point and the adrenaline rush to where he may have been a little bit more agile in that moment than he normally would have been. You know, I mean, I'm not the man's medical physician. I can't speak on whether or not he has any fractures in his back, but the reports from the jail doctors say that he does not. So all I can do is take their word for it.
Well, let me ask you this, Kiki. Do you think the sentence was fair?
I've always said that I'm pro-verdict in that he is guilty. I do believe, and I still believe to this day, that he was well within his right to defend himself and the young ladies that were working in the store with him that day. I just feel that he crossed the line when he shot the last 5 shots.
Mm-hmm.
I uphold, you know, the criminal justice system. I believe that it was developed for, you know, for a jury of 12 of his peers to review the evidence. And based on their review of that evidence, to come back and say he committed murder. And based on how the law is written, the sentence for first-degree murder, they felt that he exercised the malice and the forethought that was necessary for it to be deemed first-degree murder, and the penalty for that is life in prison. And I agree with it. Yes, I do.
Well, Mr. McKesson, life in prison or, you know, with the possibility of parole, he has to serve at least 38 years in prison. That's really life for real. I mean, because if he's 59, you add 38 to that, that means more than likely he will die in prison. Do you think
correct.
That was excessive, though?
Excessive sentence?
Yes.
No.
Really?
I mean, I will certainly tell you, and certainly anyone that wants to hire me in the future, certainly I understand, you know, from a defense standpoint, you want to try to prevent things like that from happening. But there's certain crimes in Oklahoma, and first-degree murder is one of those in which we say that the punishment, whatever the sentence is, you have to do 85% of it. And the prison system says that the life sentence is the equivalent of 45 years. So 85% of 45 years is 38 years. And, unfortunately for Mr. Ursuline, you know, he's at a stage in his life that he's statistically not going to live out that sentence.
Right.
But unless we start chipping away at the system that we say is acceptable, then that 85% standard applies no matter what the age of the defendant is.
Okay, now and I'll pose this to everybody on the line. What is the likelihood that Governor Mary Fallon will get involved with this particular case? I mean, she says she's going to wait for the what is it, the Board of Pardons and Parole to do their thing?
Pardon Parole Board.
Parole Board, I'm sorry. The Parole Board to do their thing. What's the likelihood she's really going to get involved?
I honestly don't know. I could see her going out of way on the issue. I think like a true politician, she's going to look at every possible avenue and figure out which is going to give her the least downside, and I think that's how she's going to ultimately go.
Wow. And I would like to also mention that, you know, on the several of the Ursuline support pages, a lot of the supporters are very vocal in not reelecting politicians if they do not agree with, you know, their stance on this issue, you know, stating that they don't want to reelect D.A. Prather, they don't want to, you know, reelect the judge, you know, and so politics, you know, has always been at the forefront of this issue. And my argument on the first show was that if politics is so much a part of the issue, then why is race not?
Mm.
And there was a lot of disagreement, you know, in when I stated that. But how can politics be such a part of this issue, but race is not? And the race card is not to be pulled. You know, race is a part of the issue, whether people want to, you know, dance around it or not. You know, it is a part of the issue just as much as politics is an issue.
Well, I think it would be crazy, now I'm just saying, to pick your next governor or pick your next state senator or whatever just based on this. I think if people make their next decision on their, you know, elected officials based just this case, I think that's crazy. But that's Facebook and other blogs, but I think that's just, that doesn't make sense.
Terry, let me jump in. And when we had Senator Shorty on, and hopefully I'm not overstepping myself on this, but as you recall, after the show, there was a discussion about, you know, the fact that the senator was able to get on a, you know, on a very public forum and state the things that he said, which I just quite frankly was shocked and appalled that any rational individual would say some of the things that he said. But one of the things that we talked about was that surely that man was able to get on and say those things because he knew that he had the political backing that he needed to hold his position. And what I would say is for those of us who don't like that, if we disagree with people that are going to oust a politician because they prosecuted and upheld the conviction of Ursuline, then those of us who are opposed to it also need to get our voices out there and say that we also will be opposed to politicians who just simply selectively dispense justice. That if, you know, as I say, if we don't like the system, you change it for everybody. But if you just change it for one, then you tell the politician that we're not, that, you know, that we're going to do everything we can to oppose them. So, you know, as much as I disagree with the Ursuline supporters' comments, you know, we can't just simply sit back and complain about what they're doing because we have the exact same power and let the politicians know that, you know, that there is another side that will also vote them out if they're acting unjustly.
I agree.
Because, you know, at the end of the day, what someone said to me after they listened to the show with Senator Shorty is that he was absolutely playing to his voters. And it was all about saying the right thing. And they felt like what he said about pushing the Jerome Ursuline bill and the fact that he would kiss Ursuline if he could and those kind of statements, he felt like he was absolutely playing to.
Carrie, you know, I didn't participate in that show, but I did listen to the show. And I found that to be one of the biggest examples of political grandstanding that I've ever seen. And I found it, I mean, I even found it interesting, and, you know, you mentioned some of the things that he said. Those were, like, direct quotes from the Ursuline support page. A lot of the things that he was saying and the one-liners and things like that were things that I've read personally on the Ursuline support pages.
Wow.
And, you know, when you have a forum like the Internet and you have a page with 6,000-plus supporters, what better medium is there for a politician to get on a radio show that has been advertising on the support pages, come in, support, listen in, we'd like to hear your thoughts? I mean, that's free campaign advertising there.
And that's true. But let me switch gears for a second. One thing that stood out to me in this particular case is law enforcement seemed like they threw Ursuline under the bus. It looks like they, you know, they started leaking the, you know, because I was one of the first people to get that that 911. But there was the interrogation videos and the video of the shooting. Do you think that was their attempt to say to the public, he's going to get the maximum sentence, so we want to show you all why? Because I'm sure that with the petitions going forward, there was some nervousness on the part of law enforcement that the community wasn't going to think that they maybe got it right. So maybe was this information being leaked like it was their attempt to kind of squash some of that?
I wondered myself about that, Carrie, because and I'd only have to defer to Mr. McKesson to clarify, but I thought that maybe the reason why everything just started hitting the Internet and there was so much information that was readily accessible, like the x-rays from his arm, you know, the 911 tape and all of the evidence that was actually presented to the jurors, I thought possibly that was made available at that point because he had already been sentenced. And so it became a part of the Open Records Act at that point where it was available to the public. But because the jurors were not necessarily sequestered and they were allowed to go home, to put that stuff out there could potentially cause problems, you know, during the jury trial for them to have access to things and the public to have access to things where at that point the case, you know, the trial was closed. So it wasn't necessarily wide open to the general public like that. So I don't know.
If somebody has noise in their background, can you mute if you're not speaking, whoever has that noise in the background? And I agree with you, Kiki, because when I first requested the 911 tape, I was told by the police department that they couldn't give it to me. And I said, well, sure you can. You can give it to me because the investigation is no longer ongoing. And they said, but he's appealing. I said, well, how can you appeal and you haven't heard the sentence? I said, he's been convicted, but he can't be appealing the sentence because it hasn't been rendered. And then they call me back and they go, okay, we're going to send it to you. So after that, it just seemed like everything started to kind of, you know, be filtered out there. So I was wondering about that. Mr. McKesson, have you ever seen a case where they put so much information out prior to a man being sentenced?
It's not that common. It has happened, and it's always in these high-profile cases. You know, I don't have a clear answer as to why information was leaked out in the Ursuline case, but certainly it was very political. It's certainly something that somebody wanted to, get a message out for, you know, for their particular reason or cause.
And you know, I thought from what I understood from, I think, the NAACP president, Anthony Douglas, that came on the second show, didn't he say that at first they were calling Ursuline the hero, and then all of a sudden, you know, things shifted, and then he was the murderer? Why did things shift so quickly, or how did they shift so quickly? I understand from Mr. Douglas it's because the video footage had not been released prior to that. And so I think the video footage came out when someone who worked at the pharmacy had a pizza party and was showing the footage to their friends. And that's how the video footage actually got out there. So I'm trying to understand, did law enforcement not ask for the video from the beginning? Or did they ask for it and they just weren't given it? Because it makes no sense to me that a police department would go in on an investigation like that and not notice that there are some cameras there.
You know, Carrie, I'm wondering if if the investigating officers initially became aware that there was video inside the store during the interrogation, because if you go back and look at the interrogation videos, there's a segment in those videos where Ursuline is talking about a previous robbery. Like a burglary where someone came in and he made a comment. You can see him on the tape, like where he came in and he was talking about the lockbox or a safe where they locked all the narcotic drugs up every night. And he was kind of joking, you know, kind of lighthearted about it when he was referencing this burglary that took place.
Yes,
and I think if they did not know that there was video that could have potentially captured the actual shooting, they knew at that point, because that's when he made reference to video cameras in the store. So,
but that would have been,
you know,
early on. That would have been day one.
Yeah,
Well, should have been, especially nowadays in time. How many places you know that really don't have video?
So did the police department
yep.
have access to the video and just was not going to give Ursuline, I mean, or was not going to let it be known actually what happened until maybe the video footage got out to, like, the NAACP?
But you know what? That was a segue into the NAACP getting involved, because if you go back and look at the interrogation videos, the police officer that was talking to Ursuline honestly just seemed to be going through the steps and the process and questioning him and getting some information, because he was pretty vocal about, you know, and there's nothing to worry about, you know, it looks like it was self-defense. And he really didn't seem to be leading Ursuline in a direction as if trying to get him to admit to doing anything wrong.
Hmm.
You know, the tone of the interrogation came across as if their initial, you know, presumption was that he shot the young man in self-defense. But it wasn't until the videotape was released, then it's like, okay, now the tables have turned. And I notice a lot of the Ursuline supporters are kind of blaming the NAACP for shedding light on that, and that's what kind of spawned the whole indictment.
Really?
Well, and Carrie, if I can add in, I would say, to me, it's a shame that it took a videotape
yeah.
to bring justice
mm-hmm.
forward, because I truly believe that if there had not been a videotape,
yep.
like I said, I think Ursuline walked in without an attorney, because Ursuline just figured all he had to do is just tell his story and no one's going to question it. And without the benefit of the tape, I think that he could have told just about any story and people would have just said either they accepted completely or ruled that there was insufficient evidence to contradict his statement. So
mm-hmm.
so if the NAACP, if they're the instrument that caused the videotape to come forward, then I'd say God bless them.
If you're listening tonight, call in. He's the Oklahoma State conference president down there, and he's the one that told us that on the second show. If you just tuned in, you've come center stage tonight for the topic, reaction to the Jerome Ursuline sentencing. It took place today in Oklahoma City. I'd love to hear your views on what you think. Do you think the jury got it right? Did they get it wrong? I was boycotted on the second show by a lot of the folks down in Oklahoma, and I really didn't understand that. They were mad at Kiki because they thought Kiki, you know, was mean on the first show. And then second show, Kiki, they didn't call in. So I even said on the show, y'all can't blame Kiki tonight. You know, what's the problem? So it looks like they blame me when I didn't say anything. I don't think I said what I thought on the first show. I didn't say what I thought on the second show. I haven't even said what I thought tonight. But they seem very upset down in Oklahoma City, which was very strange to me, because looking at some of the comments on the internet, I was sad for the community of Oklahoma City, to be honest with you. And I pray that peace comes over that city, because it seems to me that if somebody down there in charge does not step up and say, you know, kind of like Rodney King did after the Rodney King beating and the city of L.A. got out of control, I think Oklahoma City could be sitting on that kind of powder keg after this particular verdict. I really do. Because
well, I just, I, you know, I, with the the first show, you know, I don't know. I'm guilty of being passionate and believing in my position on the whole issue, and I disregarded the passion that the Ursuline supporters also had, you know, from their perspective. And, you know, hey, hindsight is 20/20. If I had it to do all over again, my tone and my approach would have been completely different. But it is what it is. You know, everybody has their perspective, and I think each side really needs to respect, you know, each other's perspective and their position on the whole issue. They got mad, and they wanted to boycott you, and they said some ugly things about both of us. But at the end of the day, everybody has their opinions. They're just like buttholes. We all have them. And, you know, and it is what it is. I don't take it personally. I just look at it as that's how they feel and just keep moving.
Yeah, and that's exactly how I absolutely agree with you. You know, I really, though, listening to some of the comments that were made on both shows and then reading the information that's been on the Internet, I really do feel like somebody needs to step up, though, before a Rodney King situation happens and somebody retaliates against somebody because they feel like, you know, the verdict wasn't fair, and say, you know what, what's done is done. You know what I'm saying? You know, this guy had 2 years to come up with a defense. You know, his attorney was the attorney of his choice. It wasn't like they gave him a public defender, you know. And Irvin Bok said he did the best he could. Now, whether or not that was the case or not, I don't know. Do y'all feel like he put on a good defense for Mr. Ursuline?
No.
Or could he have done better?
I don't. No.
Really? Why not?
I mean... I can't speak on how he presented himself in the courtroom because I wasn't there, but I do feel like he should have exercised a lot more discretion in giving his client approval, not only the approval, but appearing with him on a nationally syndicated television show with Bill O'Reilly after charges have been brought against him for first-degree murder, where the investigation is still pending. You actually appear on a national television show and sit there, and pretty much Mr. Ursuline sat there and perjured himself, you know. And as an attorney, I would hope that he would step in and say, you know, I don't think this is a good idea, and then allow him to repeatedly use the media outlets to voice his opinion about things, you know, and as his attorney, not interject, and then ultimately during the trial not put him on the stand. You know, I think that was one of the things that hurt him, because had he kept his mouth shut and remained silent from the beginning, he possibly could have gotten on the stand and maybe the outcome would have been different for him.
Well, why did Ursuline not testify in his own defense?
Well, let me kind of back up. You know, I'm not going to say whether Irvin Bok did a good job, but what I can say as a criminal defense attorney who practices in the very same courthouse that he does, one of the things that, you know, a lot of people don't understand is, first of all, you know, there's only a certain degree of control that you can have over your client, and I agree with Kiki in that I don't understand why Mr. Bok would agree for his client to go on any talk show, much less a nationally based one. But I can tell you that I've had clients who I've had the advantage of talking to them before the police, and I've said to them, you know, if the police come, keep your mouth shut, give them my phone number, and that's it. And the client still sits there, invites the police in, sets them down for, you know, tea and cake, and confess the entire, you know, and confess the entire story. So some of this, Mr. Bok might have been saying to Mr. Ursuline ahead of time, he might have been saying, you know, you don't need to be on TV, you don't need to be doing this, but also the client gets to control which direction his ship goes. But then the other thing is also, you know, and certainly I would say, you know, if we are going to change the system, one of the things we need to change is, to some extent, the power that we give the trial judge, because the trial judge can be extremely instrumental in what information comes in and stays out.
Mm.
And so if the judge overruled several of the defense motions, as I understand, and my understanding is Mr. Box had between 20 and 30 witnesses that he proposed to call, but the judge excluded all of them, well, then, unfortunately, that's not the attorney's fault. The attorney can't control what the judge does. All the attorney can do later on is appeal it, but then we have an appeals court that 90% of the time is going to say what the trial judge did is okay. So Mr. Box might have had his hands tied beyond the point that all he could have done is what he did.
Well, let me ask, what happened in this case? Let's just say you are you're a good business owner and you're closing your business one night, and a would-be robber comes into your place of business. Will the way that this case turned out cause you to second guess how you will react? Second guess yourself before you pick up your gun to defend your business, or will you still take that first shot and not worry about what happens after that?
It's interesting that you bring that up, because if this Ursulin Act that the Senator Shorty is proposing to get passed, if that gets passed, then there's not going to be any ifs, ands, or buts about it, no thoughts about it. It's basically going to be open season.
But see, they were saying, and I don't know if it's true or not on the internet, they were saying that some business owner or pharmacy down there questioned, when a robbery situation came up after the Ursuline shooting, he second-guessed what to do, because he was confused as to, if I do this, then I could be sued. If I do that, then I could get killed, which in essence, in those seconds while you're second-guessing yourself, could get yourself killed. So is it going to cause other people just all over, I guess I shouldn't just say Oklahoma, but everywhere, to question what to do in the situation? Or, did this case leave a gray area, or is it clear to all of those that are, non-supporters that Ursuline just acted wrong? The first shot was clean, but the second, third, fourth, fifth, and sixth was not.
Well, I think if you're an individual who thinks I'm just going to blast someone just because they had it coming, then, yes, hopefully it will cause them to have pause and second guess. If you're someone that's saying, I honestly am going to just use enough force to stop someone and do just that, then overwhelmingly, the citizens of Oklahoma have all agreed that if Ursuline had stopped at the first shot and if Antoine Parker had died of the head shot alone, then, overwhelmingly, the citizens have said that was justifiable and Ursuline would be a free man today. It's when it comes down to these people that just want to shoot and never ask any questions, then hopefully, yes, this will cause them to start thinking before they start shooting.
What was the testimony of the two ladies that was in the pharmacy? I don't think I ever heard what they said happened.
I
remember the 911 call, but that was just one person calling in. What was the testimony at trial from these two ladies? Did they testify?
I didn't read, a whole lot as far as testimony from them. I just read a couple of things, I think, from the young lady named Megan.
Mm-hmm.
She stated that Mr. Ursuline was a hero and that he saved their lives that day. And that's the only thing I read about, about them.
Because I would think
I think she also added that she'd been a previous victim of a robbery.
Okay.
Yeah, I read that too, yeah.
So whatever he did, in her opinion, was probably going to be okay then.
In her opinion, he was A-okay. He was a hero.
Mm-hmm.
I just think one thing that stood out to me when I watched the interrogation videos is the way Ursuline spoke of his guns. You know, to me, it's a 45 or a 38. He was referring to him as a judge and a Celtic.
Right.
And that just stuck out to me. I don't know why, but that just seemed odd to me, the way that he referred to his weapons. You know, it just seemed like, I don't know. So someone was explaining to me, I believe it was Mr. Dixon, what were you explaining to me that the judge meant?
Well, the judge is a gun that uses two type of shells. One of them is a shotgun shell, and one of them is, like, I think, a 45 shell.
And so you said it is called the judge for what reason?
One of the reasons it basically sells the overall situation.
So, you know, just playing. And that blew me away. Because you remember how he was describing the gun in the interrogation video, and I pulled the judge, and, you know, and I was thinking, well, who calls the gun by the judge? But if you think of that being the case of what Mr. Dixon just said, then that just kind of tells you he knew that was going to take care of everything. So if he shot him, and I believe the judge is what he pulled first, then that means there was no need for the second, third, fourth, fifth, and sixth shot.
That's true.
I'm just saying. But that was something I learned, you know, and I thought that was very interesting that was the case. So, I don't know. Did the 14-year-old get a stiff enough sentence?
Believe he got life.
No, he didn't.
Not the 14-year-old.
Wait, the
no,
one who was 14. Wait, are we talking about the one that was sentenced today?
No, you're talking about,
no.
You're talking about Anthony Morrison and Emmanuel Mitchell. Who got life?
Okay,
but the 14-year-old
okay,
was the one who came in pharmacy.
The 14-year-old is the one that had the gun,
mm-hmm.
And he was put in juvenile detention. He was placed in juvenile detention, and he was not certified as an adult. And mm-hmm. my understanding is that he's eligible for release when he turns 18.
Javante Ingram. And I really don't know that I feel like, I mean, he's the winner, if there's a winner in all of that. And I don't know that he deserves it.
I don't know, Kara. I don't know if I would describe him as a winner. I really honestly feel like he got a pat on the wrist. I don't think he was held as accountable as he should have been, because he was there and during the commission of his crime, and he was the only gun holder. You know, Antoine ended up being killed, and I think he should have been held more accountable than he was. I don't necessarily agree with his
being
going to juvenile detention. I think he should have been certified as an adult and sent to prison.
But what did the law say? It doesn't matter what we think. If the law says that they did.
Well, I was asked what I thought, so.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
But see, Mr. Dixon, though, the thing is, you know, I think it could have gone either way. It was really the judge's call on what his sentence was going to be. And I think the situation is the young man was 14, but he did come into the pharmacy that day with a gun. And so. I think what I'm saying is that maybe he was coerced into doing it by two adults, but at the same time, to go and put him in a juvenile facility with a lot of juveniles and then at 18 or 19 release him doesn't exactly seem fair. You know, everybody else, Jerome Ursuline gets life in prison. The two adults that coerced him to do it, they got life in prison. Antoine Speedy Parker, you know, was sentenced to death because, you know, he died that day. And the 14-year-old at 19 gets to live the rest of his life out as though nothing ever happened. I don't know
well,
if that
but
was
he
bad.
Made a plea deal. He made a plea deal, and he testified against the two adults that, you know, were driving the getaway car that were responsible for coercing him and Antoine. So when he made his plea deal and testified against them, that was his deal, that he's not certified as an adult and he gets to, you know, get out of the detention center when he ages out.
Okay, does anybody know why the 16-year-old and the 14-year-old was hanging out with this guy? I mean, this seems like Morrison, he's 45 now, so he would have been 43 then. Emmanuel Mitchell, who was the other adult, he's the 45-year-old and 37, they're 37 now, so that would have made them 35 and 43. What was 14-year-olds and 16-year-olds doing hanging out with these people? I mean, these are adults, good and grown folks. Why were they hanging out with them?
good question.
Was that ever established? Was there a gang involved? What was the situation? That first of all, these old people look like they should have had some different company besides some kids. So I'm trying to understand, was it the situation of a gang, or what was the cause that these young kids were hanging out with these old folks?
I'm not certain, but I believe the 14-year-old's mother was in a relationship with one of those guys. I think one of the gentlemen was her boyfriend. Not Antoine's mother, but the 14-year-old that had the gun.
Wow. Wow. Ooh, wow. Now, that's scary. I never heard that part, but that's absolutely scary. Because I couldn't understand, I couldn't make the connection with, you know, what situation these masterminds could have found themselves in that would have put them in the company with these younger kids, and then they would have had the mind control to cause them to do it. Because I understand that Javonte Ingram said in court that they didn't know that they were going to rob the pharmacy until they were in the car on the way to the pharmacy. So that to me seems unlikely. I don't know why I don't believe that, but that seems to me unlikely. Because
and something that we should also keep in mind is that, you know, I totally agree that, you know, Antoine didn't deserve to die the way that he did, but I also understand that he had a prior record, and he was no innocent child, I guess you could say. He had a prior record. So as far as the coercion part of it, I can't say that I really would you know, see things from that perspective so much, and that he had a prior record and had engaged in that type of behavior before. So it wasn't his first time.
Had he robbed a business or robbed a home or something, or armed robbery or something to that effect, you mean?
I think he had some car theft and, you know, some things like that. I don't have it up in front of me right now, but I do know he had a prior record. So as far as the coercion, I don't know.
Okay. Because, you know, I was scratching my head because I read somewhere on the Internet where they were in a gang, and I was thinking, okay, now that seems logical that, you know, older OGs could convince the younger ones to do some stuff. So that seemed logical until I read that Javonte said he didn't know what was going on until he got, you know, in the car. And I was thinking, if I'm in a car and two people tell me we finna drive up to this pharmacy and you're going to get out and go rob it, I'm going to get out and start running. So I didn't understand if I thought that, you know, you don't just do that. Wouldn't be your first rodeo. I agree with you.
Yeah, right. I don't think it was his first rodeo either.
Okay.
But he seemed like a pro when he walked in there. You know, the one that didn't seem to really have his stuff together, you know, was Antoine, because he was still trying to put his mask on when he caught the bullet to the head.
I think I asked this before you got on the phone. The blue car seemed to me that didn't fit. Did the blue car seem out of place to you?
It did to me.
You know, I don't know.
I mean, I don't know. It's just I can't imagine. And Mr. Dixon, you said it stood out to you.
Yeah, it stood out to me. One of the things, knowing that whenever something like that is going on, a person has a response. They had no response. They basically kept doing whatever they were doing.
Oh, you're talking about the blue car that was in front of the pharmacy.
Yes.
The guy that was, like, in the trunk of the car or something like that.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I thought that was odd, yeah.
And I'm trying to figure out, were those the two guys that were the masterminds, or were these some people who supposedly were just – I would venture to say these look like lookout people to me. And I don't know what lookout people exactly do, but if I had to guess, that would be it. You know, you just appear somewhere early, which makes it look like if anything happened, you were already there when they happened to show up. But you see what all is going on, but you just act like you just are, like, totally oblivious to what's going on. That seemed like crazy to me. I was going, why did they not, but they hit the gas after it was all over. Pretty quickly, but during the whole thing when people are running in the store with a gun and coming out of the store with a gun, and they didn't even seem fazed, you know. So I don't know. I just thought the blue car just, you know, I think somebody said at one point that the blue car was brought in for questioning, but they were never connected to the actual incident. But to me, that would be, to me, what I would consider a getaway car or lookout person or something. But, you know, if they were, if they weren't connected, I that's just something I just found odd. And if they were just so obvious on the camera when the camera showed the actual situation that day, you know, as it was getting ready to occur and after it occurred. There seems to be an awful lot of money that has been raised for Ursuline, or is looking like a lot of money that's being raised for Ursuline, and they're saying that he needs to get a new attorney. Will you all say that in the next case he should probably drop Irvin Box and get a new attorney, or should he stay the course? Any of you all?
Well, rightly or wrongly, I would suppose he's going to get a new attorney.
Really? Well, Irvin Box was saying they were going to appeal as though he was going to be a part of the case.
Well, if like the attorney did really good, why would you do the same attorney?
Well, Mr. McKesson just said that you have very little control over your client, so that gives me the impression that maybe when Ursuline did all these interviews that he did them on his own accord. And then maybe they were against his, possibly could have been against his attorney's advice.
Well, and that's certainly possible, but, you know, but as the pastor says, you know, I think that, you know, Ursuline, rightly or wrongly, is going to say that his lawyer was part of the problem and he needs someone new.
Let me And listen, you know, well, you got to blame somebody, but I just think, didn't Ursuline himself in many ways turn this into a four-ring circus?
Yes.
You know, yes. Which hurt him. Because, you know, you're complaining about the sheriff's department and, you know, you're saying the police department dropped evidence or lost the gun and, you know, that they didn't find the bullet casings. And basically you're just accusing everybody. In law enforcement,
yes,
you know, really is a bad thing, especially
basically, he's coming across as someone who is taking no, absolutely zero responsibility in his actions or what happened that day. Everything is everybody's fault around him, everyone else's inadequacies, everyone else's lackluster performance on his behalf in representing him. It's the investigator's fault, it's the judge's fault, it's the jury's fault, it's his attorney's fault. But you know, and when you read some of the jailhouse interviews that he's done since he was found guilty, he's been very vocal about how he would do this exact same thing if placed in the same situation. So, you know, yeah, and, you know, and even after he's been found guilty, he's still giving interviews to the media and making, you know, derogatory comments about the judge and saying, I have no faith in him at all and things like that, you know, and it's like he just hasn't learned his lesson in keeping his mouth shut.
Well, let me ask you a question that, you know, was really just the weirdest thing in the whole case to me. Why did he say he was shot if he was not shot? Who does that?
For the same reason he said he had a broken back and he doesn't have a broken back. When you're a compulsive liar, You lie so much, you start to convince yourself that these things are true. That's his reality. It's not our reality because we don't see, you know, any truth to what he's saying based on the evidence that they're coming up with to counteract what's coming out of his mouth. But it's his reality. And that may go back and stem back to whatever mental issues even Irvin Box alluded to by saying that they're trying to bring in, you know, the psychologist and someone to come in and say that there's a mental issue there.
Now, you know, I can't prove it, but he did seem a little, and I couldn't tell because, you know, I don't know what his personality was prior to this whole thing occurring. He always seemed to me a little dazed, you know, in the way his speech pattern and the way he was, you know, talking during the interrogation, you know, some of the interviews that I've heard him. He just seems a little out of it. So unless this is just the way, you know, he normally talks, he just seems like maybe he isn't all there. You know, which then that speaks to when they come back on the pill, next time they can just say he's insane, and then he'll probably get off. I don't know.
Anybody curious?
Mr. McKesson, is that likely?
No, it's not likely that he would get acquitted on insanity because Oklahoma has a very low threshold for declaring someone sane. Oklahoma insanity law doesn't look at whether or not you have any mental disorders because we have people locked up who everyone agrees has a mental illness. Oklahoma says as long as you demonstrate something that shows you knew that what you did was wrong, then you're sane. So the courts can even take lies. They say that if you lie about something, the lie is evidence that you knew that you have to cover up for something, hence you knew it was wrong, hence you're sane. So,
and if you go back and you look at the interrogation videos, he does not present as someone that's got a mental problem because he was very forthcoming and was a very good historian in going back and discussing the previous burglary, and he was very well versed on describing the guns and you know, giving the details of what happened, and he was able to recount things. And, you know, someone that is mentally disabled or has some mental deficiencies isn't going to be able to have that kind of composure when he's being interrogated or questioned. And
wow.
So that's one of the things, too, that people need to take into account. Keep your mouth shut and remain silent, because then later on during the, you know, when you're trying to come up with a defense strategy, then if you've kept your mouth shut and you haven't put all of these things out there to be used against you later, then, you know, perhaps a mental issue or something like that could actually be factored into a defense. But he pretty much killed that with all the talking he was doing, talking to the news media, the interviews, you know. He didn't seem crazy when he was on Bill O'Reilly.
I got to go look up that video, interview. I never saw it. So he did, was it a long interview? Was it a brief interview?
I mean, I found the interview to be quite interesting. It wasn't a really long one. It was, you know, a pretty decent segment that he got. But even Bill O'Reilly's body language and the tone of his, you know, questioning basically came across like, yeah, dude, you're screwed, you know. And it was interesting. And I was just sitting there with my mouth open like, I can't believe this guy is on national TV talking. The case hasn't even, you know, the investigation is still ongoing. They're still, you know, gathering evidence, and he's talking on national TV and sitting shoulder to shoulder with his attorney.
Well, he hurt himself by running his mouth.
True.
So, okay, you know, the thing that always, it was so many things that went wrong at the very beginning. How do you say to professionals who look for bullet casings every day that there was shots fired when they can't find these bullet holes, they can't find these casings? Why do you ever think he ever said that they came in shooting? Do you think he believed that because he was the drugs?
I don't think drugs had anything to do with it. This guy is in his divorce proceedings, apparently there was some information that when they were splitting up the household property and their possessions, that he was very specific in that he wanted his movies, his DVDs, his, you know, war movies, and they were all kind of centered around that same kind of genre.
Really?
And, you know, and then he comes out, you know, during this whole investigation and trumps up this whole thing about getting an injury during the Gulf War because he was in combat. So it's that goes back to the mental thing there. You know, it's like he has convinced himself that he's a freaking war hero.
Okay, so
and
he had a fascination with this stuff.
I think so. Because who says that they were
also
in combat in war?
Yeah.
And they weren't.
I think he's an individual who's accustomed to just being able to tell people a story and it not being questioned.
Wow.
Exactly. Yeah.
Because at first, was he first deemed a hero when this first was over? Somebody said, and I don't know what truth there is to this, were they getting ready to give him a parade, or was that an overstatement?
I had not heard about the parade.
Okay.
I haven't heard anything about that either.
Okay, somebody said that he was deemed a hero right after this. And so I'm trying to figure out how did the investigators go in and immediately assess him as a hero? How did they come about that?
I mean, if you think about it, when you go onto the support pages and you read, if you hear recently, as things have started to come to the forefront with regard to his military background and being in combat and those kinds of things, you know, there were a lot of references early on of him being a war hero. You notice you don't see that very much anymore because people are, I think, coming to terms with the fact, okay, he lied.
Mm.
He's not a war hero. You don't really see that. You see veteran now.
But you know what I find odd about the supporters? And Kiki, I know you heard this on a second show, and I know Mr. McKesson. Remember when somebody called into the – oh, I'm sorry, that was not my show. That was somebody else's show. I'm sorry. Karen, the lady Monahan, Karen Monahan and Alexis, who were on the first show, went and got their own Blog Talk Radio show, and they were going to show the world how easy it was to do what I do. So it's out there somewhere. They have a show in which they did about Jerome Ursulin. And I went and listened to the show, and there was a lady that called in, and she said, yeah, and for everything that had been said negatively about Jerome Ursulin, she had an excuse for it. And I just found that odd. She says, yeah, and there was bullets that were shot because somebody shot the customer was in the store. And I said, there wasn't any customer in the store. I'm listening to this thing going, there wasn't a customer in the store. But it seems like throughout this whole ordeal, on Facebook, there have been people that had an excuse for everything. I mean,
and
no matter what.
There was another reference made to he helped people out with their prescriptions. If they didn't have the money, he would give them their medication and let them pay what they could and that kind of thing. And, you know, and that's pretty much across the board an example of the emotions and the irrelevant things that people are attributing to this case that have absolutely nothing to do with nothing. You know, there's a lot of so-called Good Samaritans sitting in jail right now.
But the fact
that
you would have to lie for someone to help their defense doesn't even go over very well. When the lady said that the customer was shot, that's when Karen interrupted and said, there wasn't anybody shot. And then she goes, oh, okay. And as though just let it go now. Okay, I told that lie, but that didn't go over very well. So, okay, forget that. Let's just move on. And so I've seen that on Facebook throughout the last weeks that this has been going on, the last 4 or 5 weeks. It seems like for everything there was a defense. I was reading today where someone said, well, the robber did shoot his gun, but the gun jammed. So that's where the bullet casings are. And you're like, are you serious? So if this never came out of the gun, you know, come on now, then Ursula never got shot. So if they were just coming up with defenses like that, that I thought, if they really believe in this man's innocence, why do they feel a need to lie for him?
If the gun jammed, then where did the bullet fragments in the wrist come from?
That's what I'm saying. That's what I found odd when I was looking, because it would seem like they were so determined to prove that he was innocent that they were making statements that made it look like, well, he must be guilty because otherwise why would people feel a need to lie for him? And so that's, and I'm not taking sides, I'm just being honest, but that's what I saw on Facebook repeatedly, where they were justifying every single thing, even though it was clear that there was no justification for certain things. You know, and so if Ursulin was not shot in the arm or the wrist or wherever he said it, then just call that a lie. And just say there's no defense for that. He lied. But even in situations like that, they were saying that, you know, he was shot in the arm and this, or, you know, all of these sorts of things. And so that's what I found oddest about this particular situation. If you really believe in someone's innocence, there is no reason to lie for them.
Or make up things. And, you know, Carrie, I found it interesting during their show because I listened to that one too.
Did you? Okay.
I did listen. I went and listened to it, and there was an older gentleman who said he was a personal friend of Mr. Ursuline's, and that he actually sat down across the lunch table from him, and, you know, he was aware and had factual, you know, evidence, you know, based on his personal interaction with Mr. Ursuline, that the gun fragments in his wrist were real, it got infected and everything. And he was very vocal throughout the show. But I noticed when the gentleman came on towards the end of the show, he was a staunch Ursuline supporter and actually was in the courtroom during the duration of the trial and had some interesting comments and things to say, but it seemed that the older gentleman did not want to hear anything that man had to say.
You know what's so funny about that? I believe that was a female disc jockey out of Oklahoma, wasn't it?
But it's a black guy. It's a guy who had
I think he was sick that day and his voice was off. Right. And
yeah.
He automatically took the defense that that guy was not for Ursuline, didn't he?
Exactly. Yes, he did. He instantly took the defense and got upset with him and wanted him to hang up and get off the show. He had nothing to contribute to the conversation. And then once the gentleman started speaking, it became very evident that he's 100% in support of Ursuline, so much so that he actually participated in the petition drive.
Exactly. So you did hear the same show that I heard. And I thought that was odd, but it almost seemed it was, as though, in my opinion, the guy didn't like him because he assumed if you're black, you cannot be supporting Ursuline.
Yes. He got it wrong twice. He thought that he was a woman, and he assumed because of his vernacular that he heard over the phone, and the vernacular is that of an African-American individual. He assumed that it was a woman, and then he assumed because it was a black woman that he could not possibly be an Ursuline supporter and did not give the man an opportunity to speak before he made the assumption that he was not there in support of Ursuline and wanted him off.
And he refused to talk the rest of the show.
He did not say a word. I'm glad you picked up on that, because I picked up on that.
Yeah, absolutely. It was the weirdest thing, because they were over there, it seemed like almost just throwing out, I don't know, they had all kind of defenses for things that obviously and clearly had been proven to be lies.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and that's what I didn't understand about that particular show. It really didn't help Ursuline at all. I mean, really. And
the gentleman that... The disc jockey that called in, he actually made the same comment that Mr. McKesson mentioned earlier about, you know, Irvin Box's hands were tied, and everything that he tried to do for Mr. Ursuline, the judge would not allow it.
Mm. And is there a reason why the judge would not allow so many things in this particular case? Like witnesses, and that they said other evidence was denied. Why is it that Mr. McKesson, they didn't do that? I mean, why did the judge do that?
Well, I can only say that certain judges, because they come from a prosecutor's background, that they give off the impression that they're convinced that the accused is guilty of something, and that things that the defense brings up is a smokescreen. And so, unfortunately, we have some trial judges, because of their background, they are the second prosecutor in the courtroom. They have the ability to shut down information that a jury never gets a chance to ever hear.
And something else that was very interesting that was brought up is that this particular judge is married to a prosecutor who works in D.A. Prather's office.
Oh.
And also, Irvin Box is married to a young woman who used to work for this judge. So there's like a love triangle, so to speak, that has been, it's been suggested that there are some interpersonal issues in that whole circle, that whole group. And
but
that perhaps
that
that's
reason,
the reason why.
Reason for a mistrial on Ursuline's part? Or how do they do that? You know what I mean? When they say that, you know, that this wasn't done right and that wasn't done right, so therefore, I don't know if they call it a mistrial, but they say that therefore he should get a new trial. How do they do that, Mr. McKesson? You know what I mean?
Well, I didn't hear all the beginning of your statement.
Because of just like what you and Kiki just described, because of that, doesn't that say that maybe Ursula could get a new trial and say that, you know, all this went wrong and that went wrong, and therefore they didn't treat me fairly during this trial? So,
well,
I don't know if they call it a mistrial. They can't call it a mistrial at this point, correct?
Well, they cannot call it a mistrial, but in theory, the appeals court could reverse it. They could say that it is judicial error. But my thing is that, you know, the obstacles that Mr. Ursland faced is the same that thousands of defendants in Oklahoma face every year. And, you know, I totally agree that there's too much power given to judges, and that there's too much information that jurors never get to hear. But I say that, you know, if we're going to change it for him, we change it for all.
Wow.
You know, because Jerome Ursland is not the first and will not be the last individual who will complain about how the system is. And one of the things that I will applaud the Ursland supporters for, and I did it in the first two debates, is Ursland supporters have been bringing up issues that I and other criminal defense attorneys have been bringing up for decades, and the conservative population has ignored it as simply being, you know, some type of defense lawyer's trick. And so things such as when they complained about Ursland talking to police without the benefit of a lawyer, when they talk about the judge excluding things, you know, everything that they talked about, you know, should apply to every Oklahoman and every American. And as I always say, and as I will always continue to say, change it for him if you change it for everyone else. Level out the playing field so that everyone feels like that if we send someone to prison, that justice truly has been done and everyone got a fair shake. But right now, the supporters are complaining about things that everyone has been complaining about for decades.
And, you know, I actually found it interesting. Some of the things, you know, I'm not going to sit here and bash the Ursland supporters page. You know, there are a lot of things that are said and on that page that I think are inappropriate and that aren't fair. But at the same time, they do raise some issues and some questions that make you think. And, you know, I've always been one to promote, you know, thought and expression. You know, there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. And I read something on the page that Mr. Ursland was not Mirandized before he was interrogated.
Oh.
And I found that interesting. I've tried to do some research on it, and I've not seen anything on the internet about it or in my research of the case, but I found that interesting, and you know, that's not fair.
Let me ask you this then, and Mr. McKesson, maybe, because and you're Kiki, you know a little bit about law. if the police walk up to me, excuse me, and just start talking to me about something, and I just voluntarily just start telling what I know, do they have to give me my Miranda rights, or can they just take based on what I said because they didn't ask me to give them a statement? I chose to voluntarily give them the statement. Could that be the situation?
Well, there's two situations. If the police come up and you just start running your mouth, then there is no protection under Miranda. You just ran your mouth and hung yourself. But oftentimes what happens is the police will bring people in that they have maybe a hunch that this person has done something, but they tell the person that, no, you're not a suspect. We just need you to help tie up some loose ends.
Mm-hmm.
And our court and the United States Supreme Court has said that as long as the police don't tell you that you're a suspect, you're not entitled to a Miranda warning. So then people wind up saying things that get twisted around.
Wow.
And then the police arrest them, and then the police give them a Miranda warning. But that's where the horse is already out of the barn.
Wow. I bet you all.
But in this situation, there was a video that spoke for itself. And ultimately, that was one of the primary pieces of evidence that was used against Mr. Ursland, not just his, you know, speaking to the police officers and, you know, agreeing to be interviewed without the presence of a lawyer. He did. There was a video that caught the entire robbery, you know, on tape, and so that wasn't helpful to his case at all.
We got to get out of here, y'all. But I would say to anybody from now on, when the police bring you in a room and they shut the door and they put a microphone in front of you or a tape recorder, whatever that is, you might need to say, I need to be Miranda. What is it, Mirandized?
You need to say, I want my lawyer.
I need the lawyer up. I think that's what you need to say. I need
the lawyer up. They need the lawyer up.
Lawyer up, period, the end. I want my lawyer.
We got to get out of here. Thank you to Mr. McKesson for being my guest today. I don't know where the other two went, but they never showed up tonight. Thank you, Kiki and Mr. Dixon, for weighing in tonight. A reminder, the views and opinions of our guests do not necessarily reflect or the host. In closing, you all, there is no winners down in Oklahoma City tonight. I really pray for the community, for Mr. Ursuline, for the Parker family, for healing. That everybody just realized that this is a new chapter, and whatever happened, it is behind you now. And hopefully it won't be a Rodney King situation down there, and you all will realize that whatever happened, God was in control ultimately. Okay, got to get out of here. I'll see you all next time. Bye-bye.
Bye. With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.